Hello, and welcome to The Talkies, a weekly film podcast with me, Michael Henry.
And me, Lucy Smith.
This week we'll be discussing editing.
Yes, and something I still don't quite know how to notice all the time, or even... What would you say an editor does? Because they mix up in my head, especially because I know you direct and then you cut and then, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, I've been kind of lucky that I've been teaching this recently, so it's quite fresh in my mind that I often, instead of just saying, here's what it is, I normally ask, well, what do you think it is? Or what did you think it is? And then break it down from there. And most people tend to think that it's just cutting things out. That's it. It's just going, oh, we don't need that bit. Which, well, it is, obviously, it is that too. Like, you are trimming down the footage. But it's a lot more than that. Like, I think most people, their perception of editing is because they've shot videos on their phones or for YouTube. But really, it's about creating relationships between shots. You're guiding the eye of the audience. You're telling us what to look at and for how long. You're really just moulding the energy and the pacing of the whole thing.
I was going to ask about pacing, yeah. Is that purely the editor's job, the pacing, would you say?
I mean, a lot of it's done on... it depends on how long the shot is. It depends on the directing of it and stuff like this as well. But I would say generally, yeah, the pace is kind of... made in the edit. I mean, you could write really fast dialogue, but if you shoot it in a wide shot for like 10 minutes, it's not going to have the same feeling as as you cut back really fast between people arguing, like in your pick this week, for instance. I think the main thing really is just molding the energy and creating the feeling that you're supposed to have as an audience through the cuts.
And I would say, I think we should start with your pick because I barely noticed... Well, I assume some sort of the time editing in like fade outs to black or fades between scenes. I don't know, that feels quite dated. I don't know why. But other than that,
there's a lot of cross dissolves.
It seemed quite seamless.
But...
I didn't notice a lot, but I did notice that there was always something going on. There was barely any downtime in the whole 3 hours.
Okay, that's interesting. Because my pick for the week is The Godfather, which I'm not going to introduce properly because pretty much everyone's heard of it, even if they haven't seen it.
Yeah, I saw it for the first time.
Yeah, and I think it's one which people, when they do watch, they don't tend to be disappointed. It's kind of, it's held up as the greatest of all time for very good reason. But the reason I chose it for this week and not for, say, cinematography, which it could have been, and not for, you know, if we do want an acting and directing, which it could, it's kind of perfect all around. The reason I chose it is because the lack of cuts in some ways is better editing, if that makes sense. So I think a lot of films these days, they're overcut, and you know, it's kind of, let's just create energy by cutting a lot of time and let's not let anyone get bored. Whereas this does a lot of holding on someone and then only cutting when it's necessary or when you can say something with the cut. I mean, even the opening, like there's an opening monologue where someone's saying, oh, I believe in America, and it's kind of this beautiful 1 or 2 minute long thing, and it just slowly just moves back and moves back and moves back. It doesn't cut, but when it does cut to Marlon Brando, who's obviously the Godfather, when it does cut, there's more weight to it,
yeah,
because you've had this build of tension and then a release.
Whereas I noticed that. I feel like only good actors can pull that off as well.
Yeah, I mean, if either of them were bad actors, you wouldn't be able to, you know, stare at it for so long. You'd be like, God, this is terrible.
And to retake scenes that long as well, to be that dedicated and focused.
Yeah. I mean, when I was trying to pick for this week, there's loads of other choices for this. I mean, we've already talked about There Will Be Blood and Hunger, unfortunately. Hunger would have been a great one for this, but those are films where they do hold and they don't cut, because they know you're leaning in more. You really start to have this sense of tension the longer you hold on a shot. And when you cut, there's a responsibility to the audience to make it matter, in my opinion anyway. Like, that's why there's a lot of cuts in this, and there's a lot of cuts in those other films I mentioned, where you feel a sense of like weight, or it feels more important when you do see something else.
It's like a good writer who chooses where the chapter breaks. Like, it is important.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I feel like in some of the Godfather scenes, like you feel more in it when they hold. Like there's bits where they're talking at a table, then a guy goes back to answer the phone, comes back. It feels like you're there watching rather than they could have cut to him on the phone and stuff. But no, it creates like more weight to it. Yeah, as you said.
And I would argue, I mean, I do think this is a perfect example of editing, but I wouldn't say films that are faster paced. For instance, a film like Goodfellas or basically any Martin Scorsese film, which has a lot of editing and is very fast paced in places. I'm not saying it's bad to make a film that feels fast in places. It's just the greatest editors, you'll notice, they tend to know when to slow down. Know when to, like Wolf of Wall Street's a good example because it's a very fast paced film, but there's a lot of scenes in that go on for maybe 5 minutes or so, some shots that go on for 30 seconds to a minute, and knowing not to cut at those points in the film, it's like a signpost for the audience to go, oh, actually this must be really important. More so than the stuff we've seen before.
It gives it emotional weight. But my thoughts are, like, what I don't get is the scene length and what's said is decided by a lot of other people before it gets to the editor. Why is it their choice when to, like, is it their choice when to cut? And
it's okay, so it would be more of a collaboration. Like a director would have probably the final say, but
okay,
a really good editor would fight the corner of what they know is best for the scene, for instance. You're right, like if a scene has been written as a third of a page by the writer, and then the director goes, oh, I feel like this is more important. I make it so that it's going to be 1 or 2 minutes of a lot of visuals with hardly any dialogue, so we don't add any writing. It might end up with the editor and might end up back being shorter because, you know, everyone acknowledged the director was being self-indulgent at that point. There's this famous saying that there's three stages of making a film. You make it in the writing, you make it in the shooting, and you make it in the editing. It's made three separate times, essentially.
There was one thing about the editing of Godfather that I would have liked. Well, I think maybe I'm like trained by more modern films to need it, but so basically whenever it cut, but it had been years, the cut was just a normal one. Well, for a lot of them, and you only realise it's been years because someone says it, or like someone's suddenly got a son or something. And that, I don't know, I feel like parts of dialogue that I should have been paying attention to were kind of lost because I didn't realise how much time had passed. That's probably my deal. But yeah, I don't know, I'm so used to this, like at least like the date coming up on the screen, and I guess that's in editing too. And
I don't know. I this is what I like about the film too. I know the bit you're talking about with the kid just cropping up essentially.
Well, there's a few. There's one where he surprises his ex-girlfriend as well and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I've been back a year. And you're like, oh.
But I think that in some ways that might have been trimmed in the script stage from the novel, and it might have been trimmed just when they were editing. But I like that. That's what film can do really well, is jump forward in time. It's not like you were lost. It took you a couple of seconds to catch up. I think a weaker film would have just gone 2 years later and then done it. Whereas it's in...
Yeah, I get you.
It's in like one line of dialogue, you know, I've been back a year or so now. And it's not him just offering it up. She asks. I'm not going to talk about writing because this is perfectly written too, and I've been talking about that.
Yeah, I guess maybe I just wanted some slight help. Like maybe their fade outs could just be when... I don't know.
There's a couple of cross dissolves that there's a lot there where they were trying to the guy who finds the horse head, for instance, in his bed, that was a sequence which they said they were stuck on for quite a while, and it was through finding it in the edit and overlapping a shot with another shot and then the music with more music, and it's two pieces of music kind of fighting with each other. That's stuff they found in the edit. So
that's interesting.
You know, those kind of minor imperfections, I think, yeah, were probably just a result of it not being as fully formed as they'd thought with some areas of it. I don't remember that many scenes where it faded to black, though, if I'm honest.
I just remember, because I was trying to pay attention, and as I said, a lot was just felt seamless and like it was going on in the background very well, but I couldn't pinpoint it. So I was watching for how scenes ended, and there was a lot of fade to black.
Well, the relationship between scenes too is always really important when it comes to editing. Like it, most times, I mean, rewatching your pick this week, I noticed a lot. People tend to cut on a sound to introduce a new scene, or they introduce music, so you know you're in this new place and time.
Mm.
I think in terms of stuff being lost, I think that is one thing with a film like The Godfather and Apocalypse Now and any of these films, is that they're quite dense in some ways. Like they pull off so much in 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
That it's only on rewatching. Because I remember the first time I watched it, that the fact that the opening of the film is 30 minutes of a wedding, not just like one scene, but a whole sequence. I remember you are just dropped into it. Like no one's going, this person's going to come back in the final third and it's going to be important. You're introduced to everyone in that first third. And then it's only later on you realise, oh, wow, okay, the threads were there so early.
I had so much trouble because a lot of these men looked the same to me. I got Sonny and the guy who beats up his wife mixed up all the time. I got a lot of men mixed up. I need to watch it again, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And,
but I did really enjoy it.
I can understand why as well. It's like
I loved the ending.
It's amazing. I've got nothing but praise for this film. And to the point where I was talking to someone ages ago about perfect films, and I was like really stretching for something I didn't like. And there's only one thing I don't like in this film that doesn't work for me. And there's a sequence where Sonny goes to beat up the guy who just talked about the wife beater. He goes to beat him up in the street. And there's a couple of punches where he clearly just is nowhere near the other actor, but they add a sound effect and the guy responds to it. That's the only bit really which doesn't work.
That bit, but I was watching with Joseph, and that bit made me laugh.
But, you know, it's a minor flaw for a film that kind of was ground. It was essentially like the first blockbuster in some ways as well. Like, I don't feel like people make films this epic and writerly. And yeah, there's the level of craft in this film is kind of unmatched, except by the same filmmaker and the same team for Godfather 2 and Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, I would need a lot of time, given that there was so much packed into 3 hours, before I even considered watching the sequel. But I quite like the ending as it is, and I don't know if I want to know more. I just like the idea of a cycle.
I think it's probably worth watching at some point. There's a lot of debate on whether people think the first or the second one's the best, because, like, on a formal level and a technical level, the second one is so much more original because it shows the early days of Don Corleone, played by Robert De Niro, who's Marlon Brando in this film. And it parallels it with the life of Michael as he's becoming more and more like this devil. This, you know, he's losing his soul more and more through decisions. But you're right. Like, I've always preferred the first one because it is this perfectly contained story. There's a degree of cycle there where you know how the person at this, how his father at the start is who he's going to become by the end of it and all this kind of stuff. It's, yeah. I'm going to stop rambling because I'm just saying I love it basically over and over again. So should we move on to your pick?
Yes. So mine is Romeo and Juliet by Baz Luhrmann. And yeah, it's got, when I thought of editing, not really knowing how to think of, like, how to recognise it, I just thought, well, this is a film where I notice editing entirely. Like, it was done in the 90s and I love the way he's adapted Romeo and Juliet. I think it's so smart. And the whole world is very brash, loud. There's whip pans, there's like sped up people, there's cuts, there's people in TVs like coming at you on a black screen, and like the editing is so heavy.
Yeah, it's very opposed, like you're very aware of the cuts in the film.
For sure. But I really love the way it's done.
Well, in some ways, it's kind of like your pick's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum in that it's very fast paced and frenetic. And Baz Luhrmann's amazing at creating energy just immediately and mood immediately. And even though I feel like most films are over-edited these days, I think this has a very good balance. Like it's very fast, like overly fast-paced in places, and it is campy, which is exactly what Shakespeare was. You know, it was high art and low art. It was very slapstick as well as deep, meaningful human experience.
And Romeo and Juliet as well. It is too, like, he's in love with Rosaline before he even sees her, and then suddenly switches. It's like, they're so, like, short attention span. It's so sort of, I don't know. He grasps, like, the teenagery, like, fixation, obsession thing with it, I think, because it all is just a huge tacky world in a lot of ways. And even though I believe their love, I think it's really well acted as well. It is still you know, he meets her, marries her, and that's it, you know. I think they don't lose sight of that.
Yeah, it's kind of an old-fashioned, like, naive form of love.
Yeah, and there's no way for it to mature. But I like, yeah, I like that he used editing. I think it was risky, and you got to get the right balance. But yeah, I love the way he did it. And yeah, the whole point is tackiness and craziness, so...
Yeah, it feels like an MTV music video in some places, but then it could have been a bad film if that's all it was, but there's so much of, like talking with The Godfather, like there's that holding, and he slows down when he needs to and really takes the time, and I think that's why you feel so much of the characters all the way through, and especially the ending. Like, the ending's a good 10 minute, it's a 10 minute long scene. I was looking at it, and it didn't drag, but there was more of a weight to it because it was taking its time. And in particular, sound editing. Like, the sound in this film is incredible. And overlapping, especially the party at the Capulet mansion. Like, the sound editing there is amazing because you've got, like, 8 different songs being introduced at once and the kind of overlap. But you still know where everyone is in the building. And
I've watched this, a dozen times, but this is the first time I noticed that they echo songs that are going to come as well. When Juliet's got her head in the water when we first meet her, it's just like an echoey underwater version of a song that's going to come at the party as well. So yeah, I love all that. And there's a lot of flashiness, and I guess he's making a point. This is a spectator sport, like that's, you know, the TV at the beginning and end. But yeah, as you say, there's also a lot of slow moments where the editing is just nice and clever, like, and seamless. So yeah, I think he's proven, maybe part of whoever edited wanted to kind of prove, look, I can do the actual stuff too, we're just like playing around here. I don't know, but yeah, you do need those downtime moments.
It was kind of perfectly paced, that's the weird thing. I mean, it helps that the play was perfectly paced as well, but it's perfectly paced in that once you've had that downtime, things do speed up again. And that's something which I've been trying to work on with my own work, is like knowing how to shift energy into the next stage, because you can just get into a rut of this is the pace it should be, and this is how, and it starts to get a bit repetitive after a while. One guy I wanted to bring up was Walter Murch, who he was the sound editor on, I think it was Godfather, definitely Godfather 2, and then he was the editor on Apocalypse Now, and he's kind of considered, not the greatest of all time, but he literally wrote the book on it.
His name is familiar. Was he the Return of Oz guy?
Yeah. That's the first time I mentioned him, yeah. But he set out like 6 editing goals in order of importance. And the first one was always achieving emotion. Like, it was always, it's more important than advancing the story. It's more important than creating a rhythm. And, you know, it doesn't matter if there's continuity error as long as someone feels what they're supposed to feel. And like, emotion should drive a film. It should be like a sequence of moods. And this in particular, there's like a million moods in this film.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the same scene.
That makes sense. I guess a lot of the editing in this it's interesting too, because obviously everyone knows the story anyway before they watch the film. And then in the film, you've got these like future projections of like montages of what's going to happen and stuff, which obviously...
Well, it's interesting, like it kind of opens with a trailer for the film.
Yeah.
When you think about it.
As does the play.
I didn't know that about the play.
Tells you what's going to happen. Well, yeah, they just basically tell you they're going to die.
It was doomed to happen this way, basically.
Yeah. And yeah, and all that. And that obviously affects the pacing, and you're not sort of always carried along with the story in the way you would be with, say, The Godfather. But as well, I guess that in itself gives you the emotion of foreboding that is the main emotion of the entire play and film. So
yeah,
it's weird that mixing up the story in that way as well can make emotions.
Well, one thing I was thinking rewatching it was, it's still impressive to me. This is like 24 years ago it came out. It's still impressive to me that it feels fresh. Like, I always have this recurring, not nightmare, but kind of real world fear that everything has already been done. And I don't know how someone could approach something as iconic as Romeo and Juliet and then make it their own. Like, this is definitely a Baz Luhrmann film. It gave me hope in a lot of ways, because I was watching it going, oh, okay, yeah, that's uniquely him.
Yeah.
But it's a story everyone already knows. And even though you know how it's going to end, even in the ways we just talked about, there's still a sense of it unraveling before you, and you're there with the characters every step of the way. It's impressive
for sure. And I think a lot of like stories, like you write a love story film, you pretty much know how it's going to end unless you want to bum everyone out, but we still watch. I don't think, and we all know we're going to die, but we still live, you know. Like, I don't think knowing the story already ruins things for people. They want the bits in between, and like, as you say, the personal flares and the
It's the appreciation of the details along the way, I think.
I wanted to ask, talking of details, like things like, would Baz Luhrmann's editor have used a filter and stuff like that? Because all the colours are so crazy bright and, I don't know. Would that have gone on after the filming?
I mean, because this was the 90s, a lot of it would have been filters on the lens rather than and the film stock. I mean, because it was the 90s, there was an overlap of digital and film, so yes, in some ways they might have pushed the colours, but I honestly think a lot of it would have been on the day and costume choices. Obviously, like, Romeo wears quite vibrant
Only once, shirts. Just the Hawaiian shirt. Otherwise, I noticed Romeo and Juliet are the only ones who wear neutral colours in the whole thing, until Romeo then has Friar Lawrence's.
But there's a lot of colour in the whole thing, like even the neon crosses in the church and stuff like this. Like, it's a very kind of pop art kind of film in some ways, but like we said, like, that is Shakespeare.
The storm coming in the sky, that's edited, right, and things like that.
Yeah, that hasn't aged very well.
Like,
I was rewatching, going, oh, that's a CGI sky. Oh, it doesn't look very good. It looks quite 90s, but that's probably one of the few things I could pick up on as a negative in the whole film.
But you gotta make it theatrical, and like Mercutio's last words echo in as they do and stuff. I love all those touches.
I like that. I think, going back to the idea of instead of cutting and holding, there was one bit in particular which was one of my favourite moments the first time I watched it, and now I kind of figured out why, was after Mercutio dies, which is quite powerful anyway, they just hold on the wide shot as Romeo runs in the distance to get into a car.
Yeah.
And it's probably a good 30 seconds or so. Like, anyone else probably would have, I would have probably filmed them running with the actor running to the car and, you know, pushing his brother away and arguing and getting in the car and driving off. It just holds in a wide shot.
Yeah. Instead, Mercutio's body is always at the front. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I mean, where this film has a very good balance. It's very much, you feel the weight of the death there, because, you know, you have nothing to, you have to look at it.
Yeah.
Like, you're not cutting away. The problem with a lot of modern films is the cutting away ruins the emotion, or it kind of saps it of any emotion, especially action films. But the one I wanted to bring up in particular was Bohemian Rhapsody, which has already been slated online. There's video essays on why it's one of the worst edited films ever. But the fact that that film, it won the Oscar for editing that year. And it is terrible editing. There's like 26 cuts.
Who judged that?
A lot of stupid old white people, basically. I mean, basically, if you can be a member of the Academy and then you get sent screeners and you watch them and you vote, that one, it's less about the editing. It's more the politics of trying to show diversity, for instance. But I don't think you should be giving an award to something as the best editing if it is bad editing.
Yeah.
It's so bad. I stopped watching. I hated that film so much.
I never saw it, but I just, probably quite biased because of this, I just watched the clip you showed me of like it cutting to everyone's face as soon as they said anything or had a reaction, rather than just letting it be. Like,
yeah, it's bad on so many levels, but we're not talking about that film.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of, I think that kind of goes to show that most people don't really have an idea of what good editing is.
Yeah.
I don't want to say anymore, but just generally, I think YouTube and the fact that anyone can edit on their phone or on their computer, I've met so many young people who they're a YouTuber or they make their own little videos and they think they're an editor because they've made some cuts. It really isn't that. It really is a case of what we've talked about. Like, but yeah, it is an art, and it's an art that even I don't think I have a full grasp on yet. It's very much, how can you give weight to a shot alongside another shot? What's the information you're giving? What are you trying to make us think and feel, rather than, oh, I cut there and it made you laugh.
Like, yeah.
That seems to be where we're at, is kind of draw attention to the cut or do a weird, cool transition, like slapping the lens, which is terrible. Yeah. I'm going to stop. I'm going to sound like an old fart, but...
Fair. I was just going to say, like, I assume it, like, budget is a factor and things like that, but with films, like, the way you can edit, is it lead to better editing to have more cameras set up so you can choose what shot you go to rather than be stuck with the one that the director chose on that day, or...
I could see how it could be useful, but I'm veering more and more away from... It's called coverage, where you basically... It's more of a TV term, because they would just shoot four cameras rolling at the same time and then figure it out afterwards. Especially as I get older, I'm realising the... I don't want to just say importance, but, like, I have more of an appreciation where I know a filmmaker only had one setup, and they definitely knew this is the way it needs to look, and the shot coming up next is definitely the one I need for it afterwards. I can see how it'd be helpful.
So with more prep, that's all you need.
Definitely. Like, in the past, would just shoot shot, reverse shot, just so I know I've got the scene, and then have some what I consider more the important shots throughout. Whereas I'm shot listing now, and I know exactly when I'm going to be cutting the film that I haven't shot yet. Like, I know when I'm going to cut a film that I haven't... I'm going to shoot in 6 months' time, and I'll be editing in, like, 7 or 8. But I've... Through the shot list, I already know what the most important thing we need to look at is in each shot and all this stuff. Whereas I think there's a downside too, that Woody Allen tends to not do coverage, and he just shoots like three takes of the scene, and he'll block it out, and it tends to be most of the time really well done. But the problem is you're limiting the editor to how they can shape it afterwards. I think you need a bit of leeway in terms of options, maybe, but
yeah.
I don't know. There's no one way to do it, but I've noticed the films that I admire the most, like The Godfather, apart from maybe one or two moments, it's very much prepared ahead. Like, the director had a very clear idea of how it should be done.
Yeah, I guess it's with
the story's advanced in a very emotional way because of it.
Yeah, with anything, like, knowing what you're going for when you start off. Like, obviously, happy accidents can happen, but with any piece of art, I think having a clear vision from the start is always, and they're usually the best things.
Yeah.
Although, have you given yourself any leeway for when you edit your film?
Oh, definitely. I'll forget all the decisions I made. Like, I'll know, based on the shot list, what I wanted. But if I know that, it happened with Anhedonia, there was a couple of moments where one actor, I realised their character was probably the more important, but I realised it after the fact, so I would hold on them more. And a good example in The Godfather is when Michael shoots the guy in the restaurant, a lot of that, in my opinion, I could be wrong, a lot of that is created in the edit. So the use of sound design, the use of sound editing too, like the train there, and holding on Michael as he's thinking about killing the people there, and not sure if he can do it. They definitely would have planned, there's a very distinct camera movement there, so they would have planned... But I think they would have beforehand thought, okay, we can cut to this to show what he's looking at and thinking. But the editor would have gone, no, trust me. Like, it's so much more tense because it holds on him for a good 30 seconds.
Yeah, and the train made it for me as well.
The train. And that's the beauty of sound editing too, is that you can create a sense of something that the audience kind of knows, but then they start to feel it.
Yeah.
Which I think Romeo and Juliet definitely did as well. Like, Jill Bilcock, who's the editor of that, is very good at, especially in the opening of Romeo and Juliet, there's a lot of sound cues from different films, like westerns and stuff like this. They're just dropped in quite immediately, but then taken away. So it's not like one score throughout the whole sequence. There's like 8 different sound cues. And
yeah, and that goes with like the freeze and the title card for each character and stuff. Yeah. I thought that was done really well. And your film will be COVID-permitted filmed next year, right?
We're still in pre-production at the moment, and obviously we've delayed a little bit because of COVID, but the plan is definitely we're going to be filming end of June and about half of July, and then I'll be editing like crazy throughout the summer, and ideally probably be releasing March 2022.
Nice.
Thank you for listening to The Talkies. This week's episode was editing. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. And remember to tune in for next week's episode.